Good evening and welcome to Town Square, our first live program following a very successful conclusion to Celebration 2015, and many, many heartfelt thanks for all of your support. Now, the phone lines are open, so you can get through if you'd like to join us tonight, and we hope that you will. The number, as you probably know by now, is 941-3689. If you call us from Oahu, use that number, or from the neighbor islands, 877-941-3689. With the end of the Hawaii Health Connector and the shift to the federal site, some 8,500 Compact of Free Association citizens in Hawaii will need to enroll in Obamacare next month. For many of them, this will be their fourth insurance program in a six-year health care journey that started with MedQuest and was followed by Basic Health Hawaii. Then Governor Linda Lingle forced the switch over the cost to the state, and moving from one program to the next has been anything but easy for non-native English speakers and those with health issues, which characterizes many COFA migrants. Tonight on Town Square, we're going to consider this and other parts of the Micronesian experience in the U.S. and Hawaii in a discussion that we began on The Conversation. It's based on Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair's multi-part series. He's on our panel, along with two who have worked to enroll fellow COFA citizens in what they say has been a very difficult transition for which the state is largely at fault. Around our table tonight, Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair. He spent well over a month traveling throughout the COFA nations, Washington, D.C., and other mainland destinations, and Hawaii, for his research. His extended series on Micronesians in Hawaii and the U.S. has informed our reality check segments over the past week on The Conversation. Joachim Jojo Peter is here. He is from Chuuk and actually an outer atoll in the Mortlocks and is a PhD candidate at UH Manoa in Pacific Island Studies. He also leads COFA CAN, that's the COFA Community Action Network. And to round out our panel, Sheldon Riclon, M.D., from the Jabson Department of Family Medicine and Community Health. He's one of two Marshallese physicians qualified in the U.S. He continues to be actively involved among the Marshallese and other Micronesian populations in Hawaii as one of the founding members and current chair of the Micronesian Health Advisory Coalition and is an active member of COFA CAN. Thank you all for making time for being here.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I want to start with you two because we've heard a lot from this one over here during the past week.
Too much, probably.
No. But the point of it is that the way you have observed the situation is not the way the two of you have experienced it. And I'm just very curious, as we look at the Micronesian experience in Hawaii and in the U.S., what is it that you think that people misunderstand or don't understand at all about COFA migrants? Sheldon, we'll start with you.
Sure. Thank you for the question, Beth Ann. That's a very loaded question. And, you know, definitely can go into the different history of it. But I think there's a lot of misunderstanding of who the COFA migrants are, who the Micronesians are. And unfortunately, there's a lot of confusion and stereotyping in the community as far as who we are and why we are here. As many maybe already know, you know, in 1986, there was a Compact of Free Association between the United States and our three COFA nations from the Marshall Islands, Republic of Palau, and the Federated States of Micronesia, which includes Chuuk, Pohnpei, Kosrae, and Yap. And this treaty, in exchange for the U.S. control over the land rights, air rights, and ocean rights in the region, about 2 million square miles in the region, we are afforded free travel. You know, so we can travel out of our nations, come to the state of Hawaii, go to the mainland free with no visa, no length of stay limitations. And like many other family members or other groups, you know, we travel for three main reasons, you know, to seek health care, to seek education, and of course for job opportunities. And unfortunately, the journey has not been that easy. And part of it is, I think, people don't understand the history that the U.S. and the different COFA nations have together. It has a very special relationship, and we see each other as more brothers and sisters than anything else. That we help each other out. We are very friendly nations that we exchange and have a symbiotic relationship that we help each other out. I mean, so much so that many of your citizens are also in the military. Many of your citizens who are in the state of Hawaii pay local taxes. We pay state and federal taxes like anybody else who are in the states or in the U.S. And because we do all that and many more, expectations are we should be getting the same kind of benefits like anybody else who pay taxes and who are able to enroll in the military and who are able to travel in the different states. And unfortunately, and maybe Jojo can go into this a little bit more, is that the struggle that we have now in terms of health care and accessing it at this point.
Jojo, jump in here. Mm-hmm. I'm curious from your perception of everything that you've just heard Sheldon say and what you have experienced yourself, what you feel that people don't really understand well about the struggle in healthcare for Micronesians
yes.
and life in general.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of those things that we have to reiterate, and Dr. Sheldon Rickland touched a little bit on, and of course was all in Chad Blair's series, is we call this group COFA citizens. And really, and I think the play that we need to understand here is the Compact of Free Association. And that's really what we're labeling this group of Micronesians, because COFA is, citizens and those under the agreements are really just part of those three, are citizens of those three nations, Republic of the Marshall Islands and Palau and then the Federated States of Micronesia. That's where the larger also Micronesia, Guam and CNMI, Saipan and all of them, and of course culturally Kiribati and all those. But we're talking about Micronesia then. And especially, like, given the U.S. presence in Guam and CNMI, because CNMI is a commonwealth of the United States. So I think we need to understand, and people tend to look at this from a just one side of the equation, that all of these COFA citizens are coming in. That's where it's really, like Dr. Sheldon pointed out, it's a relationship. It's a relationship under one treaty between United States on one side and the COFA nations on the other. So we've enjoyed this long partnership, this long relationship, started after, especially with this particular document and treaty, started, I think, after World War II. And when the United States realized the strategic values of those islands, and, of course, subsequently with the atomic bomb testing and all of the other things that were going on in that region, and the exclusive military access, strategic denial that the United States has. So there's that history of it. So back in history, there's that larger history of it. But it is also in the presence, because United States continues to enjoy that exclusive military strategic denial under this Compact of Free Association. So it continues, actually, for many, many more years, right, beyond certain significant portion of that compact agreements that benefited the islands, island nations. So United States' exclusive right to the islands is sort of exists almost in perpetuity, as where, so that is part of this long relationship. And that is what we committed to. And one of those things that was agreed upon during this process, which took about 13 years to negotiate, is that open immigration part. And really, the part of the open immigration is to make sure that, you know, whatever was left undone during the trust territory period would really not affect, you know, too much the islands if once they go on their own to become self, independent, through self-determination. They are independent nations, by the way. So that open immigration was sort of a safety valve. So should people need to move to take care of some of the issues that they are not able to take care of at home, they should be able to come in, establish themselves, pay taxes just like everybody else, and benefit from those tax dollars that they contribute to the communities. What has happened so far since 1996, when President Clinton and the U.S. Congress decided to reform the welfare program, the PROA Act, is that they, for some reason, the COFA citizens were left off the eligibility. Actually, they were actually removed from the eligibility for the Medicaid program, which pays for a lot of the other services that are existing, like here in the States, you know, the Medicaid program, federal part of it, the states, and of course on the larger federal level. So that started the problem. In a way, everything was okay. When the compacts came into effect for the Marshall Islands and the FSM in 1996, everything was okay up until 1986. Everything was okay up until 1996 when the U.S. actually changed the rule. Changed the rules, really, against the spirits of the treaty, which basically then makes us, it's sort of like it provided us with an uneven benefit, you know, from the to the programs that we were contributing into, and again later on, State of Hawaii in 2009 started proposing the Basic Health Hawaii, and then as late as last year through the court cases, they actually did implement removing about 7,600 COFA citizens from the MedQuest program. So we're paying into those programs, but we're not eligible in the same program. So right now we're at the cusp, at the eve of another open enrollment of the Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act program, but we're going to put COFA citizens, irregardless of on paid program in this Affordable Care Act, not based on their income level, which is the determination for everybody else. We're going to put them based on their immigration status, the fact that they are COFA citizens.
And based on the relationship, the longstanding relationship.
And
that
ironically,
most people...
based on that special relationship, right. Now we are labeled and then put in a very difficult situation based on that special relationship that we've had.
If you're just joining us tonight on Town Square, we're talking about the Micronesian experience in Hawaii and in the U.S., looking at a little bit of history. A lot of people, you hear the acronym COFA and say, what's that? And don't have any idea that it's the Compact of Free Association. Tonight we're talking about what that means and especially what is facing a lot of COFA citizens now, as there's going to be a switch with the end of the with the Hawaii Health Connector, and now all about 8,500 COFA citizens are going to have to get health care through the federal site, and getting Obamacare for them is not necessarily going to be the easiest thing to do. I know that both of you, Dr. Sheldon Riclone, and also Jojo Peter, you've been trying to help that process move along, and we're going to talk about that in a second, but I want to bring Chad in here for a little bit. We just got a history lesson, which is just a real slice in about, 10 minutes of what has been evolving for decades and decades, largely quantified in 1986 with the Compact of Free Association. As you have been traveling throughout the United States and especially in Hawaii, can you give a sense of how people would react when you tell them that, you know, COFA citizens have every right to be here?
Well, I can tell you that COFA citizens themselves have said that to, I'll give you an example, in Oregon, Portland, Salem, also in Vancouver, Washington, just across the Columbia River from Portland, there's like 10,000 Micronesians, and they're from all over. They're from Yap, from Palau, from the Marshalls, from Chuuk, from Pohnpei. It's just amazing, and they're doing pretty good. They're not experiencing the overt racism that you see here in the islands. But I remember talking to one of the fellas from the Marshall Islands, as a matter of fact, and they were trying to explain to the Oregon legislature about COFA, about the history, because they're trying to get health care there too. They don't have a basic program quite like what we do, and often they have to go to an emergency room. But Oregon, in many ways, actually helps take care of that in some cases. Fairly progressive about it. But they had to go and educate 60 senators and 30 representatives and explain to them their own history. I mean, Sheldon and Jojo are right. It is a shared history. It dates from 1944, really, when the battles were going on between Imperial Japan and the U.S. forces. And it is intimate. And yet, most Americans are completely clueless. I think something that came up the other night, when we think of bikini, most of us think of a bathing suit. Well, for Marshallese, bikini is a very different experience. It's the site of the first nuclear testing, the fourth bomb to be exploded after Los Alamos and Hiroshima and Nagasaki. 67 tests in all, and a wee talk as well. So it's amazing that we don't know this. It's not in our history books, at least in most schools. in most districts. And we just took 10 or 15 minutes. Imagine trying to explain that to someone who's like, well, I got to get going here. I got to get back to work. It's very difficult to get that across. It's complicated, but it's very, very important.
Tonight, if you're joining us and you want to participate in this conversation, if you have a question about COFA Citizens, about the compact, something that you just don't understand and you'd like to get some clarity, call us. 941-3689 is our number. If you call from Oahu, that's the number to call. And from the neighbor islands, or if you're listening to the live stream someplace else, 877-941-3689. You talked about a moment ago the overt racism that they feel in the islands, that the people that you were talking to on the West Coast, the Pacific West Coast, didn't necessarily have that same kind of experience. Do you find it at all ironic, all of you, that here we are in Hawaii and we profess so much aloha, and yet for a very legitimate reason that you that Micronesians are supposed to be here, there are a lot of people who do not necessarily feel a great sense of aloha. In fact, they feel quite the opposite, as we've been seeing, as we've been watching the homeless situation play out. Sheldon, you want to take that?
Sure. I mean, unfortunately, I mean, that is very true. And like you said, it is very unexpected in the Aloha State, you know, because we see ourselves more similar to our native Hawaiian brothers and sisters as Highlanders or as Pacific Island people than anybody else. So to get a better welcoming or kind experience like on the mainland is very unusual to me. I've traveled to other places, especially Arkansas, at least a couple of times to work with the community there. And the aloha,
excuse me, it may shock a lot of people that there is a pretty decent Micronesian community in Arkansas.
Yes, it's estimated between 7,000 to maybe even 14,000 Marshallese who are residing in northwest Arkansas, Springdale and Fayetteville to be exact. The reasons why they migrate there, again, is similar to the reasons why they migrate here to Hawaii, is education, health, and, of course, job opportunities. Most of the Marshallese who reside in Arkansas are actually working at the poultry plants, you know, Tyson's and Butterball and some of the other poultry plants in Arkansas.
So for Thanksgiving, if you have a Butterball turkey, it may have come from someone who was
quite
on the line and from Marshall.
Yes,
Marshallese.
Absolutely. And also, as you probably know, Walmart is based out of northwest Arkansas, Bentonville, to be exact. So a lot of Marshallese are also working in those, you know, big industries as well. But there are also other Marshallese who work in some of the other areas at the university, some of the community health centers and such. So when I traveled there a couple of times this past year, it's a very different environment. For somebody like me from the islands to go to somewhere in Arkansas, the middle of the continental United States, I expect something different. I'm expecting, because, you know, it's supposed to be where the KKK folks are supposed to be based out of as well. So I was expecting more discrimination than anything.
Even if you introduce yourself, hello, I'm Dr. LeBlanc.
Absolutely, yeah. But when I actually got there, it was very different. They were very welcoming, very kind. All of the people that I work with were very enthusiastic about working and helping out the Marshallese folks or Micronesians, whoever they came across with. And they were very welcoming. It was kind of the experience that I had expected when I came to the state of Hawaii. And I've been in Hawaii for a long time. Half my life I've lived and stayed in Hawaii. And I've shared that, and I've lived and I've felt the love from my fellow Native Hawaiians and other, you know, folks here in the state of Hawaii. But it has changed over the years. I mean, it has changed over years, if more so that I myself have been discriminated against in Hawaii, which is shocking to me, you know, thinking that I'm kind of like a local boy because I kind of grew up here since I moved here from high school to go to college, then worked here all my life.
Jojo, have you experienced just flat-out discrimination here?
People just kind of, as soon as you say, you say you're Micronesian or you're COFA citizens, of course, in people's mind, there's a certain perception that is associated with those terms. They were not very popular. But I think, you know, if we want to touch a little bit on a reason what I think maybe some of these issues have sort of been exacerbated in a way. And I think what is tend to be lost in all of these, and again, going back to this, you know, partnership, you know, equal, you know, relationship, equality in this relationship, is what tends to be lost is the contribution, the many, many contribution that Micronesians, you know, contribute to the local community, the state of Hawaii and the United States. Of course, we've talked already about the, you know, we've given up sovereignty over our land, air, water, and, you know, for you know, the security of national security of the United States. And that means Hawaii. You know, we, you know, the, all of those things played into the national defense of the nation. We've talked about the FSM and Micronesians, young men and women contributing in serving in the military. But there are much, much more contribution that tends to get lost in all of this discussion. And let me just
specifically what?
Bit.
Well, what gets lost?
For example, culturally, you know, Micronesians has over like 16 different languages and stuff. And pretending all of this is the contribution of one great man to the Native Hawaiian revival of navigation, great Mau Piailu. And it's ironic now that this day, as we speak, the Hokulea is spreading the word of responsible stewardship and aloha throughout, I mean, in its global navigational trip right now, foraging program right now. But in this land, I think we're still kind of like looking at each other as groups with a little, we still can't reach across to each other and to really appreciate that kind of partnership. Many young people here work, many professionals, and Hawaii has been kind of like the place where they trained leadership in Micronesia, dating back from 1960s, where all of the leaders and the Peace Corps, and not just that, but the people who are running governments back then or and now were actually trained at the University of Hawaii. Many of us, like Shelton and I, are product of the University of Hawaii system, and many, many other people. And many people work here, and they pay taxes, and they contribute. But what tends to get lost is all of that contribution. So, because, you know, the state of Hawaii continues to, you know, argue for a burden that we are causing onto the local government and the state government, and that there must be some kind of a federal, you know, fix to this, because in the Compact of Free Association, the same treaty, there is a provision for compact impact. And the federal government has not come around to see eye to eye with the state of Hawaii on what exactly is that impact cost, although they have put some more money into the $11 million to state of Hawaii annually. But again, and when the state of Hawaii submit all of these reports, one thing is not, of course, calculated in that calculation is how much we contribute to in tax, so that you will have, you know, sort of a balance sheet accounting of all of that. So, but again, you know, you can't take that argument so far that the figures, you know, of course, there will always be some kind of a discrepancy, and you know, if you want to make the argument for disproportionality. But the fact is, this is a new group that has just landed on this. And at the same time, it's a different kind of a group that has this long relationship that should already have, I think they should make things a little bit more, it should be one step ahead of, because we're not immigrants. And I think that's what people tend to make that mistake. We're not immigrants. We're legally present under the Compact of Free Association, a treaty and an agreement that reflects that long relationship and partnership between the United States and those three countries.
The way you characterize the response that you have received from a lot of people here, both of you, that there's a great deal of ignorance about COFA, period. There's a great deal of ignorance about why you're here and what you contribute and the fact that you pay taxes and that you engage just like everybody else, but that the impression is that you're here to take as opposed to make it an equal exchange of some sort. Yeah. You were at the university, though, and you mentioned that both of you came out of, both you and Sheldon came out of the UH system. When you are up at UH and you're there now getting your PhD, is the understanding any better up there now, given the fact that you've had several generations of Micronesians come and train, and now you're looking at the next wave of that? Is there any better experience for you within the UH system as opposed to just in the general community?
You know, I went to University of Hawaii, Hilo, for my bachelor's, for my undergraduate there. I felt very comfortable there when I went through undergraduate. Actually, it was like second home to me because it was Highland style. I used to go fishing with my friends. We used to go pick breadfruits and go get coconuts. And we had a lot of friends around as well who are non-Micronesians. And unfortunately, I'm not sure why it changed, but I think my thinking is that, you know, because nowadays it's more, there's more negative press about us. There's more negative stereotypes about us. So in terms of understanding, I think we're more in the spotlight, but for the wrong reasons, that people don't really understand it because of what they see, unfortunately, in the main media stream, that they're given the wrong numbers, the wrong figures, that, you know, that we're up. As Jojo says, you know, we're a burden to the state, not putting into the calculation our contributions, and that we're always there for handouts. And really, we are not, you know. But, you know, there's, of course, there's a certain population of us who actually do need help with that. But most of us are actually contributing members of society. It is definitely different nowadays in that we're more out in the public eye. It's just that it's...
So what changed? What changed that turned it from being a fairly equal situation that was under the radar to being a situation where, from what you have just said, the spotlight is placed on Micronesians for very negative reasons? And it sounds as if you're saying, you know, Mita, you're not doing your job in talking the full picture of Micronesians. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. And I think, you know, part of it is also is because when everything changed, like Jojo mentioned, with the 1996 Pura Law, that the state started looking into how much do we cost for the state.
It became a money issue only.
It became a money issue. It became an economic issue. And it put us in the spotlight at that point. And it started to kind of spread in the main media in terms of who we really are. And they started to focus on the homeless, you know, population, thinking that we were costing the state based on that, when in actuality there was only a small percentage of co-farm migrants who were homeless. I think at one point somebody in the media said we were making more than 50% of the homeless population, when in reality it was only
like 20%.
And, you know, unfortunately that kind of spread out, and a lot of the events that are out in the mainstream, whether it's on the newspaper or on the TV, is, you know, somebody's always labeling somebody as Micronesian making trouble. Somebody's always labeling somebody as a Micronesian fighting in the streets. Somebody's always labeling Micronesian drinking in public. Okay, and those are the certain few, maybe. But
the bad apples?
The bad apples. And like with any other group or any other societal society, there are certain bad apples in certain groups. But you need to look at the whole picture.
And there are bad apples in every group.
Absolutely.
There's bad apples in every group. And homelessness is not exclusively a Micronesian, I mean, houselessness.
Well, far from it.
Far from it. And unfortunately, when they make those statements and they try to walk it back, it's already out there. And it continues to add to the air that has already been so...
Which is kind of why we're having this conversation, so that people can actually ask questions. And if you have a question about COFA, about COFA citizens, if you have a question about what it is that you think, you know, our responsibility is, or just in general, anything you want to know about it. We've got two really good guests tonight who'll be happy to talk to you. 941-3689-877-941-3689. Dr. Sheldon Riclon is here. He's from JABSN's Department of Family Medicine and Community Health. He's also one of two Marshallese physicians qualified in the U.S., and he's involved with the Marshallese and other Micronesian populations in Hawaii, and is also one of the founding members and current chair of the Micronesian Health Advisory Coalition, also an active member of COFA Community Action Network, which Jojo Peter is heading. And he's from Chuuk, actually from an outer atoll, the Mortlocks, and he's a PhD candidate now at UH Manoa in Pacific Island Studies. He's here, and of course, the person who got it all started with conversations that we had on The Conversation, Chad Blair and his seven-part series on Micronesians' experience here in Hawaii and throughout the U.S., and in places that many people were probably shocked to find actually had a very substantial Micronesian population. We talked a little bit about Springdale. We talked a little bit about what you found on the West Coast. Were there other places that you found where you were a little bit stunned that there were so many Micronesians there, either because of work or because of health reasons or because they just needed to be someplace else and they were studying?
Yes, Neosho, Missouri, which is, not even 90 minutes north of Springdale, and it's actually home to hundreds of Pingopalese, and they are from the atoll of Pingalap. That's an outer atoll of Pohnpei. It's actually geographically closer, I think, Sheldon, correct me if I'm wrong, to the Marshalls than it is to Pohnpei. And very different than Pohnpei itself, which is a very mountainous island. And as is common with all the other Micronesian immigrant groups, as with any immigrant group to the United States, you're following somebody else that came before you. And usually it's someone you knew, someone that you're related to, and you send word back, hey, come and follow me. And that was the case with Neosho. And what was shocking to learn there is there was a shooting in a church in 2007 or so, and it was among a Pingalapese congregation. And that story is on our website, and everybody can read it. But what was amazing is the mostly white residents of Neosho, a very small town in southwest Missouri, had no idea that this group was living among them. And many of them were working for the poultry and the factories and for the big box stores. There were reports the day of the shooting, because the church is right smack dab in downtown, and I visited the church and spoke to the pastors. They thought they were Mexican because they thought they heard Spanish. Well, it's because they had never heard the Pingalapese language before, and they were foreign to them. They were brown skin, and so they made assumptions. Well, this brought the rest of the Neosho community, a city of about 10,000, greater awareness of their latest neighbors. But now that it's all over, years go by and everyone kind of goes back to their own thing. And like any immigrant group, you tend to stick with your own kind.
So there wasn't any longer lasting sort of cross-pollination after that happened?
No, there still is a tendency. I mean, it's a common one. There just hasn't been much integration. The place where it's happening, though, is in the schools. And you'll see that in the Springdale School system, which has done a very good job helping with language and so forth. You'll see that in Neosho. You'll see that in Portland and Salem and Vancouver. That's really where the assimilation is happening, because not only are the kids learning English, but they're meeting people that are different from them. They're fellow, they're Americans, and they're learning how the culture works. The flip side of that, and one concern that I heard from a lot of older Micronesians, was, will they be losing touch with their culture? I heard that over and over again. Well, they're playing with their iPads, they're listening to hip hop, and
right. That happens every time a new culture comes into any place.
It does.
Right? There's a first generation, and they're very concerned that somehow they're going to lose
it. I don't know how you turn that around, but I did speak to a number of folks who said there's a tendency to want to still keep attached to that. But for many of these folks, they've never been back to Micronesia. America is all they've known. So it's in that ways, it's also a typical immigration story.
When we talked earlier, and you say that this is a relationship, but as Chad's just mentioned, the relationship sort of tends to be come here and make life here, not necessarily go back, because in some cases there's not a lot to go back to, whether that means economically or just physically, not a lot happening there because a place that someone used to call home is unfortunately not able to support life without causing great harm, which you know. Is there any sense that this is a temporary move, or that there will be a return to help those places within Micronesia where there might be some sort of support or might be an industry to grow beyond, tourism, if there could be such a thing? Or is that just wishful thinking?
It's hard to tell. Most of us leave the islands to seek these with plans to return home, because we want to go home and help the people there, okay? But it's also about the people. So if you move to other islands and you come to Hawaii and you work and you do well, you tend to work for your Micronesian community, like myself and others. So even though you don't go home, but you're working in the state of Hawaii or you're working on the mainland, you tend to kind of do something that's going to benefit your people. Our dreams, like myself, is always to go back home to work there and kind of pay back and do what I've always planned to do, is basically live and stay in the islands. But at the same time, you see the struggles of the Micronesians in the States. And it's hard to leave a place knowing that your families and friends are struggling to go back home where you might actually do better because it's home. But so you tend to kind of stay here, but there's been a lot of reports and a lot of things that we've seen in terms of large out-migration from the islands. And I think, you know, it's also in Jad Blair's, you know, Civil Beat Report series that, you know, 75,000 or so actually have out-migrated from the Micronesian region to the different states in the United States.
And that's a significant population.
That is
we're talking
significant
about a small
population.
Place.
Absolutely. But then again, you know, it's more about, you know, taking care of your family. It's more about, you know, what you need to do, because we're uncomfortable getting out of our own home islands, you know, to go to a very foreign place to us that most of the time doesn't understand our culture. We don't have all of our families there, and so we're not comfortable there. We're uncomfortable getting out, but we have to do what's right to benefit ourselves, but more so to benefit our families and the community as a whole. So I think there are still people who actually still go back to the islands after they're done with their education and they've taken care of their health needs in the States, but probably a small minority is actually doing that. And unfortunately, it's because, again, struggles with the islands, the limited resources, the self-sufficiency that was the whole idea behind the trust territory agreement between the United Nations and the U.S. and the region, was that, you know, they were supposed to prepare us for self-sufficiency and economic, you know, sufficiency as well. And unfortunately, that never happened. And that was supposed to be carried through to the Compact of Free Association. Again, that hasn't happened yet.
With all the out-migration that has happened up to this point, and with that which will continue, particularly as the money begins to run out in 8 years, money that is received from the United States government, and people realize that maybe they just can't stay there, even though they would like to be with family. Are you too concerned that if that keeps happening, that there will really be nobody left?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, for myself, I definitely am concerned that the more people are out migrating from the islands, you know, definitely it's going to be detrimental to the region in terms of what's going to happen there. But at the same time, you know, it's really hard to kind of come up with an idea or a solution to that, understanding the needs of the families that need to move out.
Jojo?
Thank you. At the risk of sounding too naive, and I am pretty naive in most of the things that I think about.
Idealistic, Jojo.
Idealistic. Oh, well, first come on, you've done graveyard radio. We hear that voice.
First of all, I am studying at the College of Education at the University of Hawaii. I did my master's in Pacific Island Studies and History, and I'm a special education PhD candidate. So just want to correct that. But anyways, I think you really have to look at the larger picture of what's happening in Micronesia, especially with the Kofa nations, and then look at what's happening elsewhere, you know, throughout the world. And globalization is a reality. Environmental challenge is also a reality. A whole lot of other things are affecting us just as they are affecting everybody else. And I think our response to a lot of the challenges that our families face, given, you know, again, that limited opportunity for healthcare, education, and economics.
And the effect of climate change.
And the effect of climate change. Given all of that, how are our families responding to all of this, given the opportunities that they are presented with? I know families that Of course, yes, the numbers has been reduced back home. But the numbers in the same family structure has increased in different places. For somebody from like me from the outer island of Chuuk, 160 miles on an atoll, 160 miles off the Lagoon, Chuuk Lagoon. We have family members in the Chuuk Lagoon itself. We have family members in Phnom Penh. We have family members in Guam. We have family members here in Hawaii. We also have family members on the mainland. And these are particularly strategic in a way, where in a way our families has to meet all of the challenges that they're presented, that is presented, you know, against with us to us, given that you know education is a must, healthcare is is a great need among everyone. So yes, the numbers are reducing back home. There's a lot of for lack of resources, the back and forth movement may be limited, but a lot of the contacts are still, given the technology, the contacts are maintained. You know, so I think that's kind of like it's a little bit more of an expanded view of what is happening with the families in the islands at this point.
Well, we're talking about contact. If you would like to be part of this conversation, you better do it quickly. It's kind of strange that we haven't heard from anyone to talk about this. Maybe it's indicative of how people are regarding this whole discussion and whether they see that this has some real value or not. This is an agreement. This is something that we are all bound by on both sides, and to be able to understand it and to know why COFA citizens are here and what the obligations to them are from the United States. Part of what we've been talking about tonight, but what we're also looking at is what's happening here in Hawaii as the healthcare situation is forcing about 8,500 Micronesian citizens to have to go on to Obamacare and make yet another transition, their fourth in 6 years. So good reasons to have a conversation with us if you have any questions at all about what are Micronesians doing in the United States. We're hoping to give you some answers tonight. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Jeff from Kaimuki. Aloha, Jeff. Welcome to Town Square.
Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about a lot of the inhabitants of, that were relocated from Bikini Atoll during the atomic bomb testing are actually being asking to be relocated again because their islands are slowly disappearing because of the rising waters, because it is an atoll, and that would that contribute to any of the loss of population also that you guys were just touching on?
Before I turned over things to Shelton, and let me just touch a little bit on that. And again, you really need to look at the expanded view of how the environment affect these islands. For example, the major food crop on my island, for example, is taro roots, uh-huh. And taro roots grows in freshwater swamp. Our islands are small atoll. It doesn't take much for the salt water to inundate, or therefore, once the salt water inundate the fresh taro swamp, you have to pull everything up and you wait for another three, four, 5 months before those things start growing again. And then, so all that environmental offset of the cycle of this, yes, it does affect that. But let me just turn over to Shelton, because I think the question was particularly to the Marshall Islands where the islands are pretty much low.
Thank you for the question. And actually, I mean, just now imagine that taro root with the inundation of the salt water by radiogenic affected salt water. Mm-hmm. See, the Marshall Islands and Bikini and a lot of the atolls there, they were told to stay away from some of the atolls where most of the time or culturally, by history, we used to go and get our food crops. We'd go get our crabs, our breadfruits, our taros, like Jojo was talking about, and clams, and go fishing. But then in the Marshall Islands, if it's polluted, if it's radiogenically affected, and we were told that you cannot go and get your food from there, then we cannot get it from there. We cannot plant on some of the islands because it's contaminated. So what we usually do, or what one of the solutions that the United States had done at one point, was actually to provide those atolls with what's processed foods from the United States Department of Agriculture. So canned vegetables, canned beans, canned chicken, canned potato, spam, and all the processed foods.
Not necessarily a part of one's diet.
Not necessarily a part of our own diet.
That's what
I mean. Because we used to go planting, we used to go fishing, very healthy stuff, very active stuff. So that also, when we talk about nuclear weapons testing, we're always talking about cancers, which is definitely a big thing as well. But if you also think about it, it also affects our lifestyles. It affects our non-communicable diseases. So diabetes, hypertension, high cholesterol, all those things that are non-communicable diseases also affect a lot of the Marshallese. So part of the reason they also migrate out of there is because they cannot make a living for the families on those different atolls.
Okay.
Jeff, thanks very much for the call.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
If you'd like to join us, if you have a question about anything under the umbrella of COFA or the Micronesian experience in Hawaii or within the United States, now's the time to ask. We're taking a lot of time tonight to take a look at some of the issues that we talked about on the morning show on the conversation with Chad Blair based on his 7-part series in Civil Beat. And joining us, two people who have been intimately involved with all of that here in Hawaii and other places too, and you, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Going to Brian calling us from Maui. Aloha, Brian.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi, yes. My name is Brian. I'm calling from Maui. I just got in my car and I joined the conversation here. But my partner is a special ed teacher in sixth grade at EL school in Wailuku. And she has mostly Micronesian kids in her class. And the administration, they mentioned, oh, yeah, you can have a bunch of Micronesian kids, and it's going to be difficult. So I just wondered what steps are being taken, whether any Micronesian teachers are immigrating as well, and how this issue is being addressed, because there seemed to be an overabundance of Micronesian kids in the SMED department.
Jojo, that seems to be a question with your name on it.
Yeah, I think one of those challenges with the students that they come in and test, right? I mean, they test them right into the ELL program, and they end up in the special education programs. Is a lot of that misunderstanding sometimes with culturally and their ability to understand and their ability for the teachers to be able to be effective in teaching this island, the students from different cultural backgrounds. And I know that the College of Ed Education works very closely with the Department of Education, and Department of Education has employed some COFA citizens to work in the schools, but I think that is a long-term solution in terms of hiring more, and that should be happening, like hiring more teachers from the COFA nations, and especially in the teacher in special education.
You know, I would just add to that. For the series, I interviewed a number of educators, particularly on the Big Island. We talk about the cost for health and social services for COFA migrants, and it's a lot of money. It's $40, $50 million annually. The biggest chunk of what the state spends, though, is for education. About $90 million from our taxpayers go to help things like translation, helping them learn English as a learned language, English as a second language, and they're having a lot of success. One of the things they've done, the teachers and the principals, is they've reached out to the community to have the parents of the Micronesian kids come in and help with that. There can be a tendency for Micronesians when they come here to, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's not a forward-putting culture. It's a very respectful culture, and it takes a while to get comfortable and to
exert
yourself.
They need to be drawn in, is what I
hear
you say.
They do, but once there's a trust relation developed, it is permanent and it is valued. And so I saw examples where they were really bridging the gap, and churches also playing a key role. Wherever Micronesians go, they bring their faith, and that has been central to helping with these educational challenges.
Right. And the healthcare issue as
exactly.
Well,
yeah.
We have Eva calling us from Kaka'ako, and if you'd like to be next, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Aloha, Eva. Welcome to Town Square.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. This has been so enlightening for me regarding learning about the COFA agreement. Didn't know about it until I moved to Hawaii. I read an article from Malika Lincoln in, I think, 2013, stating that 50% of Micronesians were actually made up homeless population. Now, with homelessness being at the forefront and in a state of crisis in Hawaii, I'm just wondering, why wasn't that data updated? Because at this point, that is the impression probably most of the people are going on, that 50% of the homelessness are Micronesian.
Well, that data actually has been updated, and it has been changed as we've been able to get better data coming out of the Kaka'ako encampment, and as the data keeps changing. And there's no way that it was
50%. I'll just tell you flat out, it was completely erroneous. It was a wrong report. Unfortunately, it's on a major television network, and it goes out across the state, and you're absolutely right. That's what most people absorb when they see that. Mm-hmm. And then you see pictures of homeless camps in Kaka'ako and Kapalama Canal, but it was flat out wrong. Studies have been done by the Department of Human Services, by the University of Hawaii's Department of Urban and Regional Planning, who've actually gone out there and done the surveys, as well as the Next
Outreach
Step
worker.
The Next Step Shelter in Kaka'ako, the IHS shelter. Partners in Care, and they've done the counting. And it ranges. It's in flux like any population. It's between 17 and 21% or so. But in fact, Native Hawaiians are represented in these camps. So are Haole. So are any number of groups. Tongans, Samoans. And unfortunately, that's what's gotten out there. But it's flat out wrong. There's no data to support it. And in fact, another point to make is that many of these Micronesians are actually going into the shelters and making the transition into housing, just like so many other people struggling to get off the streets and get a roof over their head.
Eva, I'm glad you asked that question. I'm glad we can put better data out there again. You know, we've been talking about that since that data came out. And it's interesting how much people hang on to the old data, which is wrong, completely erroneous, and don't really understand that it's moving. It's a moving target. We've been talking about that, but it's such a big difference. You're talking about a greater than 30% difference.
Right, and you can go to syllabi.com and you can look at the numbers. We've linked to the UH study. We've linked to the DHS study. You can check out the data for yourselves.
Good. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you have a question before we have to say goodbye for the evening, we're talking about what happens when Micronesians come to the United States, understanding why that happens, and what is that relationship, which is, you know, a relationship of reciprocity. It's not one directional, and that seems to be a myth that's persisting throughout a lot of the conversations that people have about Micronesians and a lot of what you saw as you were traveling, Chad. We're coming down to about the last 5 minutes of the show or so, and as we look at this point forward, what's happening now? We've got 8 more years until the money's going to run out. Maybe some will be potentially reauthorized. Maybe we don't know. None of us can prognosticate. But as things stand now, is there really any path that any of you can see for what happens to Micronesia going forward in terms of being able to develop itself? Or are we looking at a constant pattern of out-migration?
The numbers are not reversing. They are probably not going to reverse. It's going to continue. Global warming is only going to add to that. I mean, when you live in on an atoll that's so narrow that you can throw a softball from the lagoon to the ocean in many spots, and you're only 10 feet above sea level, and then when that sea starts rising, the evidence is out there. Tony DeBroom, the Micronesian Marshallese ambassador, will be going to Paris to address the United Nations. Many of the leaders of Kiribati and Palau and the FSM are speaking vocally, trying to convince the major polluters of the world, China, the United States, and so forth. But what we can do here in the United States is persuade our federal government to reconsider the COFA treaty, to perhaps continue the funding, to provide more compact impact aid so states like Hawaii can help take care of those costs that they have, and to really consider that maybe it's an unfair situation. It's going to change in 2023. The migration is going to continue. The strategic relationship is still going to be in place, but most of the federal money is going to run out, and that's probably going to be very dramatic. But I tell you, that federal money is a drop in the bucket of the U.S. budget that could go a long way to helping folks that need it.
Sheldon, as you look at what happens in future, and especially what happens to Micronesians in Hawaii, what do you see?
I'm kind of scared, actually, not really knowing the future. I wish I could have a crystal ball to kind of really tell me what's going to happen. I haven't really seen anything that's reassuring, that's what's going to happen, that's going to be positive for the region. So I really do not know. But like, you know, Chad said, you know, I also see continuation of the migration out of the islands.
Which means that both your work and JoJo's work continues in a way to make inroads here. Do you see that that is beginning to open up a little bit, that people are understanding maybe just a tiny bit better?
There is some glimpse of hope by what we do and the number of people we've been able to at least reach. Number of people have actually understood, a number of people have reached back to us. So we're hoping that, you know, there is going to be some more positive impact on that, that it's going to open up more doors in the future.
And JoJo, as you lead Kofa Kan, what is your plan moving forward, even if this glimmer of hope is out there shining
a little bit more? The one thing we don't want to do is to continue to marginalize the population. Either in our in the individual act of racism that you see, like spray painting, really, or making bad comments that are just totally irresponsible, that, and also in the policies that our leaders make. Because if the goal of all of this is community integration, and I think that's what everybody should be aiming for, a large number of these individuals here, you know, are actually U.S. citizens. They're born and raised in the United States. They're American Micronesians or Micronesian Americans, depending on how you want to call it. Now, if we want a right path forward, I think the way to do it is to continue to marginalize this population, because that only makes it only makes everyone's job much harder. And it further delays the integration of a people that, or a group of people that are otherwise and can contribute more to the community. So if this is what we all stand for, you know, immigration and integrating people who see the promise and the dream of America. And are born and raised and are U.S. citizens, helping their elders here. And I think the wrong way to do it is to continue to marginalize to our people.
Well said.
Bottom line, check your attitude.
Yeah.
I want to thank you all for joining me tonight. It's been an enlightening conversation. And I know we didn't have a whole lot of callers tonight, but I'm taking that a lot of people were listening to what you had to say and getting a slice of history that they haven't otherwise received, either in school or just in life. If you have missed any of Chad Blair's series, it's all on civilbeat.com, and you can check any part of it. It's very long and lengthy. You can, if you want to just look up certain parts of it, it's all there and ready for you. Chad Blair, thank you so much for joining us, not only on Town Square, but coming in tonight just so we can have some of these conversations and learn more about ourselves, our attitudes, and our history.
Thank you, Beth Ann, for inviting us on.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Dr. Sheldon Riclone, thank you for being here. Again, if you missed it, he is from the Jabsom Department of Family Medicine and Community Health, and also is one of two Marshallese physicians qualified in the U.S. He's involved among the Marshallese community and Micronesian populations in Hawaii. He's also one of the founding members and current chair of the Micronesian Health Advisory Coalition and an active member of COFA Community Action Network, which JoJo Peter is head of, and he is from Chuuk. And actually, I know the Mortlocks. I say Chuuk. I know you're Chuukies, but you come from the Mortlocks.
The center of the universe.
The center of the universe. And is a PhD candidate at UH Manoa in education. Thank you all for being here. We'll talk to you again, and I'll see you tomorrow morning right here for The Conversation. Have a good evening.